From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. On this week's show, a Zambian woman in KC talks about living with AIDS.
I didn't even have friends. I didn't have any friends come over or anything like that. We really just didn't have a life.
Google Fiber announces plans for Kansas City residents.
If you look at the pricing structure, basically certainly their top tier for internet and their internet television product is cheaper than similar packages at other providers.
And area vocalist Lee Langston shares sounds from his neo-soul music performances.
People hear a song and you see them respond. It's like, yeah, that's my cut, that's my jam. You know, and you talk to them because they relate to that song.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
When a cow is stressed from the heat, it affects the producer's bottom line. The animal eats less, meaning less mass in beef cattle. For dairy farmers, the hurt comes in the form of a 10 to 20% loss in milk. Researchers at the University of Missouri think some of this can be prevented by putting information in the hands of producers. They've built a tool that can detect the threat of heat stress in specific animals. Scott Pham reports from Central Missouri for Harvest Public Media.
At the research farm owned by the University of Missouri, the sun is high overhead with no cloud cover. The air is thick and humid, and it'll stay this way for the rest of the summer. University researchers are leading a group of 4-H youths to the cow pens.
You can see the flank movements, really shallow. So what I want you to do is, you should have a stopwatch of some sort, right, on those things. Basically, you're going to start it, watch for 30 seconds or so, get the number and multiply it by 2 to get breaths per minute. Make sense?
Research assistant Brad Scharf briefly shows the kids how to check a cow's respiration rate using an iPod stopwatch app. They take off for the pen, scaling the fence with ease.
Oh, that's right. Don't jump.
They want to get close to the animals so they can see the flanks. Once they've counted, they can put this number into a piece of software created by the University of Missouri. It's a mobile app called Thermal Aid. The point of all this, says Don Spires, lead researcher in the project, is to combine data about the environment with data from the animals.
And it will automatically put in the air temperature and the humidity, so then the producer or the student can look at this later to see how hot their animals were under these conditions and figure out which animals are really stressed in the heat, which animals aren't. And so then they can work with them, they can treat them differently depending on how stressed they are.
According to Spire's research, it takes about 3 days for the stress to affect an animal's feed intake. So the goal is to find early warning signs using what we already know about the animals through research. The problem, according to Spires, is getting the information out there.
The thing that dawned on us is that we collect all this data, we publish all these papers, go to the scientific meetings, it's wonderful, but the producers aren't using it. We say we've got to have something that will tell them right there, while they're standing there, how hot this animal is versus how hot that animal is, so you can make a decision while you're standing there. And the apps are a beautiful way of doing that.
Dozens of fans and misters line the barns at Hines Family Farm in Higginsville, Missouri. I'm meeting with herd manager Chris Hines to see if there's a place for the Thermal Aid app in the field. According to Hines, dairy farming is all about cow comfort.
I throw around the term cow comfort. It's something we use every day. Basically, the more comfortable and at home a cow feels, the healthier she's going to be, the happier she's going to be. And as a result of those things, she'll produce more milk.
These days, a big part of cow comfort is keeping cool. This afternoon, there's a rare storm on the horizon, and a slight breeze rolls through the open-air barns. Even so, the fans are going at full blast. Hines points out a cow who's just settled into its sand bedding.
She's lying down. You see how she's chewing her cud there? So that's a good sign that she's comfortable. And you don't see her breathing real fast. She's breathing at a real regular pace. And so she's not heat stressed there.
Hines can remember particular cows 3 generations back. He knows them backwards and forwards. But if technology can tell him something more, he's all for it. I tell him about the Thermal Aid app and he immediately knows how he'd use it.
That would be a great just monitoring device to see how the different areas of the barns are. You could address problem situations, like if you had, say, a certain corner of a barn that wasn't cooling adequately, you could install an extra fan.
And those were in a feedlot, so you you would click on beef and then in a feedlot.
In the cool, air-conditioned classroom on the university farm, Kendra Stinson and the rest of the 4-H kids finally get to sit down with the app.
I think I would actually do it because I always have my smartphone with me, so I could just pull it out.
Stinson and her family raise cattle and pigs in Prairie Home, Missouri.
But I'm not sure about the older generation, so we could try and get them more involved. I know my grandpa, he's not really good at technology, but he said that he would like to try it out, so hopefully we're making some headway with that.
When we're talking about producers who aren't already using mobile technology, an app can be a hard sell. Spires hopes that when it's released this fall, he'll be able to train an outreach team that can meet with producers and show them the benefits of the tool. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Scott Pham.
This past week, thousands of people convened in Washington, D.C. to study the global AIDS crisis at the 19th International AIDS Conference. But in the Kansas City region, more than 6,000 people are living with HIV and AIDS. That includes Bester Samani, who says an AIDS diagnosis 12 years ago completely changed her life. Samani, joined by her daughter Sue, recently told KCUR's Alana Gordon that one of the biggest struggles has been dealing with the stigma of the disease here in the U.S. and in Africa.
In the southern African country of Zambia, near the capital, Lusaka, there's a phrase people may whisper to each other when someone has or is rumored to have AIDS. Kayonde yonde, or slimming, slimming. Bester Samani says it's the physical weight loss people there associate with the disease. Samani was unaware of her own physical decline 12 years ago. She was too busy wrapping up a year and a half of work and study in hotel management in Kansas City and preparing to finally return to her six-year-old daughter, Sue.
I was supposed to return on May 28. All my bags are packed and everything.
Samani recalls this while sitting inside her cozy apartment in Kansas City, an enlarged framed photo of her with her siblings and daughter, taken right before she left Zambia for a temporary visit, hangs on a nearby wall. Samani says just weeks prior to her scheduled flight back home, a good friend who hadn't seen her in a while stopped by to say goodbye. The friend immediately noticed something was wrong.
Then she's like, no, you don't look okay, Bester. You've lost so much weight. So we continued visiting, talking. And then before she left...
The friend took Samani to a local hospital. She stayed there for nearly a month, never making it to the airport, and instead battling high fevers and undergoing different operations and procedures. Samani says she had no idea why she was so ill until the day before she was to leave. A social worker came to talk about where she could access AIDS services.
So I'm like, what? You say I have AIDS? She says, yeah, they didn't tell you. I'm like, no. So I demanded that I wanted to talk to the doctor, you know, to find out exactly what was going on. Then the doctor came. He was standing like a really far by the door side there. Then he's like, yeah, you have AIDS.
For Samani, the main caretaker of her younger siblings and daughter, the diagnosis was a huge blow.
It was very, very hard. I think the hardest part was really being a breadwinner for the family. And then to tell them, say, oh no, I have AIDS. I felt like they are pretty much going to have a funeral.
The doctor then told her she'd be able to get medication here that wasn't available in Zambia, medication that would help her get better, to the point that she'd be able to care for her six-year-old daughter, Sue. So Samani stayed in Kansas City. Her first challenge of living with the disease came up before she even left the hospital. Staff warned her not to let others know about her diagnosis.
To be told, like, I can't tell anyone, it's more like I've taken a gun and shot someone in the face. You see what I'm saying? Like, I'm the one that has actually caused this problem. Whereas it's supposed to be the other way, like people feel sorry or sympathy for you because you are the one who is sick. But now you are being taken like you've caused this big problem that you can't even talk about.
Samani's daughter, Sue, who's 18 now, sits next to her as she recalls all of this. Sue says dealing with her mom's absence back home was painful.
I just remember waiting there and just being told that she's not coming and never being given an explanation why.
Sue's father dropped out of her life when she was two, and she heard relatives and friends speculate that her mom had gotten married, found a new family.
It was pretty hard and really harsh to have to deal with all of that.
Somani isn't sure how she got HIV. She says it could have been through sex, through a blood transfusion after giving birth to Sue. She also wonders if she got it from a traditional healer who cut her skin with razors that could have been contaminated. But Somani was sure about one thing. The stigma around AIDS in Zambia was huge. Somani says telling her family about her diagnosis would be more damaging to them than to her.
So it's like my daughter would receive the same discrimination and bad treatment as though she had AIDS herself. And my sister, same way, they would be mistreated the same way, like they had the disease, even though they don't have it. Just because I have it, it affects the entire family.
In Kansas City, Somani's health started to improve. She applied for asylum based on the hardships she'd face being HIV positive in Zambia. And she got the needed paperwork and funds together to bring her daughter Sue to Kansas City.
I mean, even though she had been gone for, was 3 years or so?
Two years, 8 months.
3 years to me. So even though she had been gone for about 3 years, it was just, she was still my mom.
The two were granted asylum on Valentine's Day in 2004. Now, if Somani's HIV status had been documented when she applied to come to the U.S. originally on her work study visa, she likely would have been denied entry. Up until 2 years ago, the U.S. banned anyone with HIV from traveling to the country. The change in that policy is what led to the International AIDS Conference taking place in Washington, D.C. last week. Even though Somani and her daughter were in the U.S. together, both say life in Kansas City dealing with HIV was incredibly isolating. Somani kept the illness mostly to herself. She didn't even tell Sue about her HIV status until it was about to come up during one of their asylum application hearings.
Actually, I didn't even say I've got AIDS. I just thought they say, you know, I'm sick. I've been actually sick for a long time, and that's why I wasn't able to come home. And then she says, you have AIDS. Then I said, yeah.
Well, I mean, I used to do all her drug cocktails, so it was basically every Sunday, I'm the one who's sitting there going through, like, any given time, 5 or 7 or, like, 12 different pill bottles, putting, like, what do you take at dinner time or what do you take during these times, because it was just a way to help out.
Somani says she's been lucky that accessing HIV medication hasn't ever been a challenge. But side effects from the pills and the health issues associated with the disease have at times been debilitating. In 2005, the bone in her right hip started deteriorating, making it hard to walk sometimes and threatening to confine her to a nursing home. But even when she was at the peak of her health, working several jobs, going to community college, raising her daughter, Somani lived in fear that others might find out about her HIV status.
I didn't even have friends. You know, I didn't have any friends come over or anything like that. We really just didn't have a life.
And it was also really stressful because I can't really talk to anyone about it. And I go to school and I was bullied quite a bit just for being different and for not being from here. And so it was just, I was miserable.
The two found some support. Somani got help from a volunteer with a local AIDS agency, and she connected with an all-women's HIV support and education group, one that she later assisted with. Sue found refuge in a week-long camp for kids affected by HIV. But both say these outlets weren't enough. Somani says it wasn't until she confided with someone from Sue's school about her situation, and then others, that she finally found relief.
Life just changed for the better. I mean, it became easier.
Somani says not worrying about keeping the illness to herself gave her more strength and energy. Sue began talking about it with friends and responding to peers who made jokes about HIV. Then in high school, she joined a group of young adults affected by HIV who traveled to schools around the country to share their experiences.
The only way for me to feel like I could really conquer it, it was by just kind of getting over it and not making it less important, but just kind of getting into a place where it was something, like keeping the secret wouldn't be something that was controlling my life anymore.
That just completed the whole picture, you know. That's when we started having friends over, and now we can talk about it anywhere.
Somani and Sue say it wasn't like everything was immediately okay after they stopped keeping HIV a secret. The stress from the disease and from having enough resources to survive has had a huge physical and psychological toll. At one point, Sue went into foster care, staying with a family friend while her mom recovered. But this May, Sue completed her first year at Columbia University on a full scholarship. The two were also recently granted U.S. citizenship, and with that, they finally had the chance to take a trip home to Zambia. Samani gets the impression the climate and stigma around HIV in Zambia has changed a lot since she was first diagnosed with the disease a decade ago.
Because so many people are sick. So almost every household, maybe they have someone who has AIDS. So it really doesn't make sense, like, one family to be pointing fingers at the other family when they are dealing with it in their own family. You know, it's so commonplace now that people are more accepting.
Samani says life in Kansas City continues to have ups and downs. She's unemployed right now, but wants to put her talents and skills in hotel management to work. Her right hip still bothers her, making it difficult to walk at times, and she's struggling to find treatment. Even so, Samani says she has faith. Things will work out the way they're supposed to.
And so I never lose hope. I know that I'm sick right now. It's just one of those challenges that I have to go through. I know that it's gonna pass, and I know that I've got many more years of bright future ahead of me.
Samani is spending her days applying for jobs and enjoying the time she has with Sue while she's home from college on summer break. Reporting for KC Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
Coming up, Google Fiber announces plans for the Kansas City area. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. 1,100 other cities wanted it, but we got it. Google Fiber. Since it was announced that we got it about a year and a half ago, Kansas City has been eagerly waiting for details. What is it? How much is it going to cost? And how will the city get connected? And perhaps the most important looming question, how will Google Fiber change our city? Google announced details for fiber at a highly anticipated and hyped press conference on Thursday. KCUR's Suzanne Hogan talked to Allison Rawlitz, who covers technology and entrepreneurship for the Kansas City Business Journal, about the announcement.
Google Fiber announced its three high-speed internet household packages. One provides gigabyte speeds and a cable-type service called Google TV for $120 a month. Another offers only high-speed internet for $70 each month, and one offers current broadband speed for a one-time $300 setup fee or a $25 a month fee for the first year. They encouraged the world to watch the press conference. I streamed it on YouTube, along with up to 12,000 people at one point.
Indeed. So let's do this for Kansas City. We're really excited about getting everyone connected and looking forward to writing the next chapter of the internet together, starting right here in Kansas City. Thank you.
Allison Rawlitz of the Business Journal was there.
There were just a few rows of press, and the rest were a lot of people from the community, like the mayors were there.
Sly, you know, we win big when we work together, and this is a day where we've won big because we've worked together. Now we get out in the neighborhoods and really get to work as well.
Amen, brother.
And there were also just a lot of people in the local tech community. I saw a lot of people from my beat there. I saw attorneys there that helped start startups. I saw entrepreneurs. I saw people that have, you know, been running companies for just a mere matter of months that were invited to the event. So it looked like they invited people there, you know, one, media that would have an interest, and two, people that would be excited about the news. And then there were a lot of people there in blue and white Google Fiber t-shirts, a lot of employees. Google presented, you know, several clever and funny videos, and the skits were definitely lighthearted.
Thanks, Milo. My daughter has a bit of bandwidth envy. It feels like... It feels like stuff sort of just works on the internet, but sometimes it just gets slow. And then when other people get online in the house, it just gets super, super slow.
The crowd, you know, definitely took it all in, and it definitely could, I think, would say a pep rally feel would be a very accurate statement.
Wasn't it cool?
So what is a fiberhood?
Fiberhood is a word that Google has come up with, and they very much are asking folks in the next 6 weeks to rally together and to pre-register for the product for $10 and going online and signing up. You have indicated to Google that you're interested and you're like, hey, I want this service. Google has divided
the Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri area into what they call fiberhoods, these geographic areas based on density and population and kind of topography. And they have set caps, or I guess minimum requirements, that the people in those fiberhoods need to meet in order for Google to bring them to service. And if, quote unquote, enough people express interest by paying the $10 and registering online, Google says it will bring the network to any fiberhood that reaches those minimums that they've set. And then as an aside, any of the libraries and the schools in those fiberhoods that meet those requirements and get the network to come, those public institutions will be connected for free.
Do you think that these plans are affordable for most Kansas City residents?
If you look at the pricing structure, basically certainly their top tier for internet and their internet television product is cheaper than similar packages at other providers. But there are a lot of families that can't afford internet now, and I'm not sure whether they will think this is an affordable pricing structure or not.
Yeah, I was thinking a lot about people who rent and who aren't more or less permanently based, how they would be able to register, you know, in a fiberhood, or if they would be as likely to do that.
Mm-hmm. It certainly raises some questions, but Google has said that they're committed to letting demand drive this product, and this is the way they have figured out for that to happen.
Do you see any opportunity for community philanthropy here, for certain people to sponsor lower-income neighborhoods or institutions to get them connected?
I have not seen a lot of folks come forward with anything like that, no. And we're also a day out. That could be coming in the next few weeks. Who knows? There is there's at least one group in the area that looks to be committed to getting low-income neighborhoods connected to internet broadband, but I'm not sure if they have done any fundraising or any efforts like that in order to put up the cash for Google Fiber to come to them.
So what is the difference between Google Fiber and regular internet speed that we're used to? Why would people need it?
Google essentially has the take that why not? They obviously have plugged it into a pretty expansive television service. As far as what a gigabit can do to the average person who didn't necessarily have a special Google TV product, like if you live in North Kansas City and you have that gigabit service that is available to some businesses there through Link City, it's a publicly run fiber product up there. People I've spoken to up there have said that they notice a huge difference in download and upload times, and that there's a much more successful experience when it comes to file sharing and things of that nature. So as far as just the gigabit service alone, without a television product attached to it, it does seem to be able to increase efficiency on the internet.
How do you think that their announcement about Google TV could change the market for the future?
You know, I imagine that remains to be seen. There are some analysts with some buzz today, you know, commending them for coming up with this product, that it does access a lot of the internet TV features that we've been seeing with other internet products, but that it kind of rolls it all into one. There are others that just liken it to an upscale version of cable, and that it's really not all that different. It'll be interesting to see what the market does with this.
Do you think that area cable providers should be concerned right now?
When you talk to area cable providers, they say they are not concerned. AT&T and Time Warner both released statements saying that they feel like their products are very competitive and will stand up fine to the Google product. And specifically, Time Warner has said, quote, bring it on.
So they didn't announce anything for area businesses. Do you have any idea of when they're going to announce anything, or have you heard what kind of plan they might be announcing?
All they would say is that that they had commercial options and that they would not be announcing them that day. Some of the Google officials said they didn't want attention to be taken away from the crux of their project, which were the residential services. Other Google officials really left the impression that they just weren't ready yet. They weren't very clear on what their intentions were with business products, but they were clear that the residential product was the emphasis and where most of the attention should be right now.
September 9th, they'll announce which fiberhoods are going to be connected first. What are you going to be following until then?
You'll be looking to see, you know, if that commercial, if the news about the commercial products come out. They kept saying it'll be coming out very, very soon. And we don't know if that means before the rally is over or not. We'll be looking at the neighborhoods that meet those requirements and, you know, kind of tracking who's going to be getting it. We'll be looking at community reaction to that, to the Google Fiber space in Westport. And really, what, I think mostly, there are a lot of people that have been waiting a very long time for answers, even officials that are very high up in our community governments that seemed very, not, I wouldn't say clueless, but seemed to have a lot of questions going into that presentation. So we'll be following a lot to see what questions the community has for Google after this, and if Google will answer them, and if this is the product that the community expected.
Allison Rollitz covers technology and entrepreneurship for the Kansas City Business Journal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
A couple of weeks ago, Harvest Public Media started a new series called My Farm Roots. These are American stories and memories of rural life. Harvest Public Media's Camille Phillips has the latest installment.
Last month, several generations of my family came to Parsons, Kansas to celebrate my grandfather's 90th birthday party. With all eight living Phillips siblings and their families gathered in one place, there are many stories of growing up on the farm to share. This is one from my great aunt, Jan Phillips, a teacher by trade.
My name is Jan Phillips. I grew up at Miller, Missouri on a farm. I live in St. Louis now. I'm 75 years old and I have wonderful memories of the farm. When I was young, my parents had a dairy farm. And so I was rolled out in my baby buggy to the barnyard. And the cows were curious because I invaded their barn lot. And one cow in particular got very close down into my baby buggy to see what was happening. I don't know if I was sort of making noise or flinging my arms around, but here was a cow down right next to me. And then she stood up. I must have sort of hit her a little bit on her nose. And when she stood up, my baby buggy was around her neck because she had put her head under the handle of the baby buggy. So it's hanging around her neck like a necklace. And the wheels come down and sort of hit her on the legs. She jumps. Well, the baby buggy goes out and comes back and whacks her on the legs again. And she starts running down the hillside out of the barnyard, down and then up a little hill on the other side. And apparently my folks came out panicked to see cow, baby buggy, and baby Jan going across the barnyard and down the hill. And I'm assuming that the wheels of the baby buggy must have hit the grass as she was going up the hill on the other side. And somehow she just sort of lowered her head, took it out from under the handlebars, and started grazing. My folks came running up to find me laughing. They said that they were quite certain I was going to be a very adventurous person later on. This is a very small community. Miller was probably 1,500, a very small little community. And the Kansas City Star was big time newspaper for that area. And there was a cartoon and an article with a cow dressed up like a nurse with a hat pushing a baby buggy, and it told the story of little Miss Janice Ann Robinson and the cow story.
You can find that 1937 cartoon on the My Farm Roots page at harvestpublicmedia.org. And while you're there, you can check out more My Farm Roots stories or share yours. Back in the 1950s and 60s, Prospect Avenue was a bustling center of pride, position, and of prospect. In an excerpt from an upcoming feature on Central Standard, host Jabalani LaFall talks to local historian and writer Joe Lewis Maddox about when Prospect Avenue was Main Street. Now we hear about a time before crime and ideas to redevelop the area.
What was Prospect like in its heyday?
Well, Prospect was close to, a time and place similar to 18th and Vine. Now, when we talk about the evolution and the history of 18th and Vine and Prospect, we have to go back to maybe the 40s. And from the 40s up to 1954, I would say that everybody knows 18th and Vine, 12th and Vine was a spot in the Midwest for African Americans to go and many other people to come because his reputation for jazz, good fun, good times, a barbecue, all those type of things. But 1954 brought about the opportunity for African Americans to sort of leave the confinements of 29th Street to 27th Street and maybe Truce to Benton and go other places. And the place that they were migrating to was Prospect. So you had businesses and clubs and all those type of things that moved from the 18th and Vine area on to Prospect, starting at 9th and Prospect, going all the way down to, I would say in its heyday, almost 55th Street.
You mentioned in your research a restaurant called Mooney's. Talk about that.
Well, at that time, Mooney's was one of the finer restaurants for African Americans in the area. Very nice place, appointed downstairs. I mean, you almost had to dress like you sometime going out on the plaza. They had a banquet room upstairs. And this is where people came in early in the morning. The politicians came in, and they had coffee and breakfast. So, I mean, if you wanted to meet your city council person, especially from the representative black community, this was where you go because they would be there in the mornings almost every day.
So that's why they called it the Black City Hall.
They called it the Black City Hall.
It was a place where city leaders or blacks in positions of power in the city could come and essentially talk shop.
That's exactly.
What would you say is the goal of your work when you go back and look at Prospect Avenue and you put together these articles, you put together these historical documents, these timelines about Prospect Avenue and its former glory? Is it simply just to tell the story, or is it to spark a conversation?
No, it's for me, it's for us to remember, for especially African Americans to commune, to remember. For my white friends, I mean, who say, you know, I wouldn't go near there, I want to tell them at one time, you know, this was a place where everybody went, and we were very proud of it. And what can we do? What can you help me do? And others to bring it back. I'm from the era when people left the doors open and, you know, cars, windows down and all that kind of stuff. This is not the case now. And even though we, you know, we say that there's crime on the plaza, et cetera, et cetera. You don't read about it in the paper, and you see enough security officers around there to make you feel safe. And unless you feel safe, you are not going to go into an area and patronize it with your money. Now, some people might criticize me, but if you had a policeman on every corner, you know, a cop car sitting in every parking lot, I think people would come back. When it comes to appearance of people, I think many people are afraid of the neighborhood because of the way our young men, I would say, you know, probably 12 to 24, the way they dress, the way they look, people sometimes are just afraid of them. Now, until we can get some people to say we've got to change that culture of what we think about our neighborhood, I do think that there are some young entrepreneurs who can say, well, I'd like to come back to the neighborhood and do something. If we could get young people back to move into the neighborhood and say we're going to have some standards that we're going to accept and we're not going to let anybody trample on our ideas and our values.
After the break, music from KC's neo-soul vocalist Lee Langston and Prototype. This is KC Currents.
This is KC Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Google finally announced that its fiber network is coming soon and what it will cost. But the story that affected the most people was the drought that's already here and likely will be here for weeks to come. Steve Bell revisits those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
As the drought continued, lake, river, and pond levels were down, but demand for water was up.
Megan Clobby with Water One in Johnson County said water consumption has been twice that of a typical summer.
We would expect to see around 80 million gallons consumed per day, and we're seeing around 130 to 140, and in some days, 150.
Water main breaks surged, and water departments urged residents to watch the lawn watering. Heat and windy conditions raised concerns about fires, and a 20-acre fire in the Northland came to within 50 feet of homes. Fire Department Battalion Chief Lou Hendricks told TV9 News that if the wind had shifted, the houses could have caught fire.
Mother Nature will tell you. And in this particular case, we drew a lucky card. We drew the ace.
In Springfield, the president of the Missouri Cattlemen's Association, Lonnie Duckworth, said this is one of the most severe droughts he's ever seen.
It's rivaling 1980. 80 was a very bad year. I'm not sure in some cases this might be worse than 80.
On Thursday, Governor Nixon added $5 million to a state program to help Missouri farmers meet the cost of drilling wells deeper.
$2 million is not enough. We thought it was time to push additional dollars there.
The drought is expected to continue into the fall. Midweek, the metro area got a smidgen of rain, a trace in some sections about an inch in others. Google finally ended its year-long dry spell on information on its ultra-fast fiber network, announcing it will likely connect the first customers in September, and the service will include more than internet.
You don't have to settle for old-style television anymore. After all, with the most advanced internet in America, you should have the most advanced TV experience in America, too.
Google Vice President Milo Medin, who also pitched the web-only service.
We will make Kansas City a place where bandwidth flows like water, where the fastest internet in the world is available at an affordable price.
Google also announced its pricing structure for the 1 gigabit per second service, and another company, Wicked Broadband, announced plans to bring similar speeds to Lawrence. In the courts, John Henry Horton lost a bid for a third chance to convince a jury that he didn't kill Elizabeth Wilson in Prairie Village in 1974. His first conviction was overturned and the second questioned by the state Supreme Court, but a judge in Olathe concluded that excluded evidence would not have convinced a jury that Horton had not killed the 13-year-old. Across the state line, a Jackson County judge removed the Catholic diocese from a lawsuit over alleged sexual abuse by former priest Michael Tierney. Among other things, the judge said it would probably be impossible to prove that the diocese intentionally failed to supervise him. And Governor Sam Brownback told Kansans the state's bank accounts are doing fine. The governor also said the state's finances are definitely solid enough to handle the large income tax cut passed this year.
And we're going to do everything we can here to continue to reduce the cost of state government while protecting K-12, Medicaid, public safety.
Critics of the multi-year billion-dollar tax cut say it's still likely to cause budget problems in the future. This is KCUR.
Kansas City vocal artist Lee Langston has been a fixture on the local music scene for the past several years. His covers of neo-soul music have attracted faithful audiences of young urban professionals. Langston's tribute shows celebrating the music of artists like Erykah Badu and Lauryn Hill have drawn sold-out crowds. He recently assembled a musical tribute to neo-soul artist D'Angelo, and Susan was there to check it out.
The mostly female crowd started arriving early to the record bar. The lights were low, and the venue has a warm, cavernous quality. Dressed in the vibrant colors of summer, women sip Cosmos and French martinis while waiting for the D'Angelo tribute show to begin. I asked some of the women what attracted them to this event.
Lee Langston has always done a wonderful job of bringing wonderful sounds to Kansas City, especially for those of us that love the neo-soul R&B scene.
He always puts on a really good production. I mean, I just like the atmosphere of the events that he puts on, and it's always good music and good times with me and my friends.
I like that he supports all artists. He brings together artists that maybe wouldn't be working together. he shares the stage, and you don't have to do that, but he provides opportunities for everyone's personality to shine.
I've seen Lee do the Erykah Badu tribute, and I've seen the Lauryn Hill, and I think, like, Kansas City's lucky to have him. I'm thrilled.
As the show starts, it's standing room only at the record bar, and the stage is crowded too. Not only is the Prototype Band on stage, but Lee Langston has invited a variety of local crooners to share their talents. The set begins with D'Angelo's hit, Brown Sugar. There's a mellow energy in the place as most people rock back and forth to the sultry and soulful music. The scene is electric, talented musicians, an enthusiastic crowd, and music that vibrates with passion. Not long after the record bar, Langston explained how he, like generations of soul singers, have learned music from his family and the church.
Pretty much everyone in my family either sings or plays an instrument. My dad is a singer. My mother, she did some singing. My grandmother was a singer. My grandfather back in Oklahoma was a performer also. My dad's side of the family were all heavy church, so all of them sang. I can remember at times getting together with them as a child, and my dad was like one of 13, 14 kids, and they would just get together and have these big music things at the house all the time where it would just, there would be nonstop singing, and I would just sit there as a child in amazement to just look around and go, wow, like my entire family, they are all singers. You know, I thought all my family were movie stars or something back then, because I'm like, they can all sing.
Lee Langston grew up in Kansas City, and he spent years performing with gospel groups, like the popular St. James United Methodist Voices of Praise Choir. At first, he performed secular music for an occasional party, but he didn't get serious about performing it publicly until about 4.5 years ago. Since then, he's become among the city's most popular singers in the neo-soul genre.
Yeah, it's like feel-good grown folk music, but it's not old school, if that makes sense. It's like it feels good. It's very grown. It's very sexy. But generally, when you say grown, they go, "Oh, that's the old school. That's the old school. That's the Isleys. That's the..." And it's not really the Isleys. You know what I mean? It's grown and sexy, kind of by itself, sitting over here.
And it still draws upon, you know, the soul genre.
Yeah.
Very much so.
I think what I like about the neo-soul genre is that it pulls in young and it pulls in old, as opposed to, you know, people just, they like to box you in things, and when it becomes adult contemporary, they're just like, oh, that's adult contemporary, so they'll just put it over there, you know, and neo-soul seems to kind of reach out to a lot of different people within the soul music genre.
Now, you connect with your audience. What are you feeling when you're up there on stage and you're singing?
This may sound weird to some people, but I when I'm on stage, I kind of channel people's energy. Like, you know when you're getting good energy in the room and when you're getting bad energy in the room. And there are people that want to relate with the person that's singing. So, you know, all of our experiences are generally the same. You know, we've gone through a lot of the same things. So really, you just talk to them. You just engage. Some people find it hard to engage with people that are staring at them. But it's for me, I find it really easy to engage with them, because people hear a song and you see them respond. It's like, yeah, that's my cut. That's my jam. You know, and you talk to them because they relate to that song.
Girl, it's so me. Only if you want, you can decide that it can help you.
Now, you seem to always be evolving in your creative projects. What inspires your creativity?
At the BET Awards just recently, Frankie Beverly got on and said something that really should have rang out loudly amongst all of the artists that were watching, is that no matter what they are doing, do the music that you like to do, perform what you like to do. Don't always fall into what everyone else says is hot, because people will, you know, if they feed that to you long enough, you'll believe it. And that's kind of how I feel about what's on the radio. A lot of what's on the radio is what they're trying to feed us to make us believe is hot. And a lot of it I don't like. I mean, it just, it kind of is what it is. Soul music has kind of lost a lot of its soul, in my opinion. I am the supporter of the unheard voice. Like, there are all these amazing singers and musicians that we don't hear about in the Midwest. And I've always been on this like mission to make sure that people hear them. So when I started covering songs, about more than half of what I brought in were some of the underground artists that I had heard about in various places all over, And I wanted to introduce that music to these audiences. Well, the funny thing about it is since people here in Kansas City hadn't heard of a lot of the artists, they thought a lot of the music I was doing was my original stuff. So I had to kind of teach them, you know, well, no, that's not mine. Actually, that is this person.
My woman, why are you sleeping with my woman? Came as a total surprise. I just can't believe my eyes.
This is Susan Wilson, and you're listening to KC Currents. I'm talking to Kansas City artist Lee Langston, founder of the band Prototype. So if you're an African-American artist, do you face different hurdles as well?
Oh, yes. Here, it's no secret. I've had the discussion with several of the venue owners, and it's that piece of, you know, for the venues that don't have an urban demographic or don't do anything in reference to soul music, making them believe that, you know, they all see it. They have one image of how it looks in a lot of cases. And some of them will admit that they think it's going to be a crowd of rowdy people that come through. They think everything that's in the urban demographic is hardcore rap, which there's a place for hardcore rap, and they shouldn't fear that, because I've always kind of wondered, like, why would you have an issue with hardcore rap when there's hardcore rock and the crowds are the same? There's just a racial divide in that. So, you know, because I go listen to all types of live music, I see the same things play out, but I notice that there seems to be a fear when it comes to the rap genre that, you know, I see the exact same things play out at the venues with the rock genre, but it seems to be like, oh, it's just rock. That's okay. I'm not understanding why it's okay in rock, but not okay in rap. And it's been this thing of when I bring through my audience, which are generally urban professionals that love good, grown, sexy music. They're always shocked, and they talk to me about it later, and they're like, wow, like, where has this audience been? We didn't even know this audience existed. I'm like, yeah, they exist. And it's very difficult. It's almost a teaching thing that has to happen when you bring your audience in. We have to show these venues that, yeah, we are out there. We spend our money just like everyone else. We come to have a good time. And when we come in, the venue's going to be left just the same way that it was, you know, when we came. So a lot of them don't get that.
Because of these barriers, is that why you're so passionate about nurturing young artists and giving them a place to showcase their talents?
Yes. Yes, it's exactly why. You know, it's that piece of there's a group of artists and musicians that have been here in the city doing things for years. And they realize, you know, we all realize that someone watched over us when we started. So it's our responsibility to protect the new artists, because there's so many artists out there that have had bad experiences. People see them get on these mics or get on the mics at the open mic scenarios, where a lot of people find a lot of new talent, and all they see are dollar signs. So they get these new artists and they misuse them for their own gain, you know. And so it takes people like us to come in and take them under our wing and go, hey, don't allow that to happen. Don't allow that to happen. Try to avoid doing that.
So what advice do you give?
I tell them the best thing that they can do is just to be authentically them, because a lot of people, you know, the opportunists do what they do, and they want to hop on what, again, is quote unquote hot. But I think the thing that has helped me in it is that you just get authentically what I bring to the stage, what it is that I want to bring. I bring that. Plus, you rest happy in that place because at that point, you're really, you know, gifts that we have, it's like it's God shining through us. So, you know, why would you go try and do something over there that's not authentically you, when you can do what's authentically you, and you can be married to that at the end and be okay with it, be very happy with that. So
now, speaking of your tribute shows, you've done Erykah Badu, you've done Lauryn Hill tribute shows. What inspires you to do these types of shows in the first place?
It's that piece of realizing that a lot of that good music that we love, because like you look at Lauryn Hill's album, and every person that you could go walk out onto the campus and ask someone about Lauryn Hill, and they'll all say the same thing. Like, that's a classic project that I could put on today and listen to it like it got released last Tuesday, and it still feels good like that. And it's something that came out in like 98 or something, you know. So it's just good music, and to me it's that good music that's missing. So for me, when people ask me why do I pick specifically, why am I specific about picking those artists, those are artists that just changed the game for me. Lauryn Hill changed the game in music. D'Angelo changed the game in music. Erykah Badu really changed the game in music when she came out, and those are the artists that I picked.
Well, Lee Langston, thank you for joining us for KC Currents today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm glad that we got a chance to do this.
I'm looking at you, all of them wishing they could have you, and as a matter of fact, a bunch of hope into what you smash. I'm tired of how to work with you, I'm trying to come with the wind, I'm going to make it home, cause I won't.
Lee Langston has been working on a new CD of mostly original material, but he says there's also more tribute shows in the works, including one to Whitney Houston.
Thanks for tuning in to KC Currents. The show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Or then, find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents. KC Currents is produced by Alex and Suzanne Hogan. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. And this week, we extend a special congratulations to Sylvia and her husband, Bill, as they welcome baby Rosa Mina Elder into the world. She was born last Wednesday, and she is super cute. We can't wait to meet her. So, Sylvia will be out for the next couple of months. Our intern is Zach Lewandowski, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
Stay cool.